say, look, at that time, we're going to be receiving a salvation, even though we're supposedly already born again. You see, it hasn't happened. Part of this hasn't happened. Yes, we've been redeemed. Yes, we're in his house and we're being sanctified. You go forward or backward in this life. If you don't keep being sanctified, if you don't move in being sanctified, if you're not making progress in that area, it may be that, you know, you either go forward or backward, or that you're going to stand around retarded and be the least in the kingdom because, you know, everybody else grew and matured and you didn't. I think it's a real balancing act to try to figure out how to stand still. Most people either backslide or they make progress in sanctification. And what is sanctification? It's learning to live in the light. It's learning to abide in the light. And it's getting those little darknesses out of you when the Spirit is shining on those dark areas. That means coming clean. And what I'm telling you is, it didn't just happen to Jacob. It's going to happen to you your whole life. Because it's rigged. If you were born again and you were redeemed from the power of darkness, then all those bad habits that you have that came from playing the rules of the dark ways, those have got to go. And if you do it the world's way and you know it, the Spirit's going to shine a light on that. And either you're going to be sanctified or you're not. And if you're walking in sanctification, then more and more you're going to learn what it is to live in God's house and keep God's rules. Which means more and more you're going to be conformed to the Scripture and to what it's saying for how we should live. And if you're not making progress in that, then the Spirit's going to be on your case shining light on the darkness all the time. Because in the end, when you're glorified, there isn't going to be darkness left. And it isn't just going to get ripped out of you. Well, maybe it will. Jacob style. But you see, it's out there, okay? And Jacob was learning a few things about how he could not run his problems. So God put his finger right on the ghee. And he's telling our people, don't eat the filet mignon. And when you don't eat filet mignon, you're supposed to sit there and think about that. Now, if you eat filet mignon and you're a Jew, you're playing around with what the Torah said you shouldn't do. And God's watching you eat filet mignon. I'm warning you. He's looking at that. What's he going to do about it? That's between you and him. I'm just telling you, if you're a Jew, the Scripture's telling you to remember Jacob. And if you don't remember Jacob, then you'll eat filet mignon. The chances are you'll not only eat filet mignon, you'll start getting the idea you can outrun some of your problems. And God will be watching you do that. And with Jacob, he waits 20 years and he catches up with him. Good luck if you're eating filet mignon and you're outrunning your problems. Good luck that you won't have the same fate coming down on you. Good luck you won't wind up in a box. Now, you can do it one way or you can do it another way. You can sort of, you know, make progress by meditating on the Scripture and gradually changing your ways. Or you can lurch from crisis to crisis and, you know, figure out the hard way what you should have done to keep you out of the latest box you're in. This is your choice. So, I say all this now to say, well, here's what happened to Jacob now. I'll go back to Genesis 33. And we're in Genesis 33. Jacob is limping out there to go see Esau. And he's going to go pay tribute. What he's going to do is say, oh, my brother Esau, here's this company for you. Esau's going to review everybody coming up. He's going to look at one concubine after another. He's going to look at all these sheep and goats. He sends them out 550 animals, including 50 cattle. I mean, 550 flock. Cattle, sheep, goats. And they're all balanced. Just the right number of males and females so that these herds can be explosively. I mean, this guy was an agricultural husbandman. He knew what he was doing. He'd out Laban in order to get these sheep bred every which way. He knew agricultural laws. He knew all kinds of things to balance the flocks. That's what he was doing when he was making this package for Esau. And then he says, Kachna et birchati. Kachna. Take now et birchati. Now, it's almost always translated in the English, take my gift. But if you want gift, it's matana. Birchati is bracha sheli. It's birchati is my blessing. Take my blessing back. You know, the one I stole from you. What blessing? Well, the blessing of preeminence. You know, Dad said, brother, we're going to bow down to me and stuff like that. So what does he do to Esau? He approaches him, bows down to him seven times. I thought men don't bow before men. What's he doing? Bowing to the guy. He said, I thought you only bow before God. This guy's bowing to Esau 7 times before he approaches him. What's he doing? He's treating Esau like an older brother and like a monarch. Why? Because he wants to give him back the preeminence. Why? He don't want preeminence. What does he want? Land and seed. Now what is seed? Israel, the Jews. Land. What's the land?
Israel.
Yerushalayim. The Temple Mount. God's house. God's kingdom where he's going to build it. The empire. The real empire. That's what he wants. And he doesn't care if that means he's going to be kicked around in his life. In fact, he bow down to his brother now and give him back that blessing.
He doesn't.
How does he know?
I think he's...
Remember what Abraham was told. Abraham was told, kings will come from you.
Right. But he's not told anything like that.
He grew up in his family. Don't kid yourself.
Is this...
He knew he just swore by the God Abraham and Isaac.
He was given the name of God.
He wouldn't swear by Nahor's God. He knew the whole thing.
He was given a new name, and that... wouldn't that give
him... He was at Bethel, and he said, man, this is a holy place, before he left. He got angel escorts. He just took on an angel. He knows plenty. He was a man of the books. He's the guy that's going to tell Moses about Abraham and Adam. He's the link. This is the guy who was in the books. This is the guy that's given you the oral tradition to Moses to write down. It comes from him. It got right through his ears. This is the guy. So when people are saying, you know, this Jacob, a run-around guy, it's like, yeah, but get a clue. That's when he was 70. You meet him now, he's going to look at you. He knows much more about running around than you do. This is a patriarch. And this is not any patriarch. This is God saying, I'm going to rename this place Israel. I'm going to name the nation Israel, and it's going to be remembered forever. And when they think of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the same breath, they're going to think of Israel. And that's this guy after God just beat the hell out of him. Because there's no hell left in him. That's what you're dealing with here. This is a big man now. Abraham is a tremendous father and role model. But Jacob's not to be underestimated. God came over to Jacob and he said, okay, I'm going to square accounts with you. Bang! You got Laban? Bang! You got Esau? Ah, how about a sandwich here? Now limp around for 70 years and think about it. He got the point. So, he's standing there and he goes up to Esau and he says, Kachna et birchati. Genesis 33, 8, 10, and 15. Now, you look at Genesis 33, 8, 10, and 15. He's going up there and he's saying, take the blessing. I got enough. I'm in a good mood, you know. I cut you some slack. So his brother's saying, Jacob's going, man, this guy's going to kill me. What did you intend by that whole camp that I met? He answered, to gain favor in my Lord's eyes. Motzei chen. I want chen. I want chen from you. Remember Noach found chen in the sight of the Lord? Well, the Lord's counterpart here is Esau. Just like if it's Esau's angel, here you can say Jacob's running up and doing the Noach trick. He's saying, can I find chen in your eyes? Noach found chen in the sight of the Lord, and now Jacob has to find chen in the sight of Esau. He goes, to gain favor in my Lord's eyes. Verse 8, he says, I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have remain yours. But Jacob said, no, I beg of you, if I've now found favor in your eyes. Doesn't it sound like Abraham when he's trying to buy a tomb from the Canaanites? Yeah. I insist I want to pay full price. Then accept my tribute from me. Kachna tabirchati. Inasmuch as I've seen your face, which is like seeing the face of a divine being, and you are appeased by me. Again, if it was Esau's angel, I already saw you face to face. I was up all night with you. And he's saying to Esau, I saw your face. It's like a divine being. This is Jacob talking to his brother. Verse 10. Vayomer Yaakov. Al na'im namatzati chen beinecha v'lekachta min chati biyadi ki al ken ra'iti panecha ki ro'ot pnei Elohim. Face of God. Face of Elohim. Pnei Elohim v'tirtseni. Looking at you is like looking at the face of a dying vine being. I bow down to you, O Lord. And Esau's in a good mood. But he's sitting there, Kachna et birchati, follows right up verse 11, please accept my blessing, which was brought to you, inasmuch as God has been gracious to me. God showed his hand to me, and take it, take it, take it, take it, take it. And he urged him, he pressed him. Jacob's in his face. Take it! You've got to take it! All right, already, I'll take it.
Sounds like Esau has already forgiven him even before he's come to meet him.
Yeah, Jacob doesn't care a whit. You know? He wants to give it back. He wants this out. He wants clean. He
that
just wants
counts.
Land and sea. He doesn't want preeminence. He doesn't care if he's poor. He's limping around. He cares about nothing but just get me out of here.
So is this the settling of accounts
before
he can actually, before God says, you can't go on until you do this.
That's right. He can't. He knows he's not going to inherit.
You have that in Matthew.
So the only way. It's not even up to Jacob, really.
That's right. It's up to Esau right now. Well, because he made his bet later.
He's going to have to do it.
Absolutely. And they understand he's going
to
inherit.
In order to go on. In order to move out of that.
He can't move through that space.
Okay.
He can't move anywhere. David's right. And so look how clean he's got to be in order to inherit. This is called inheriting the kingdom. He's going to walk across the Jordan and walk probably the Yabbok and then the Jordan, and then he's going to go to Succoth. And Succoth is on its way to, all the nations are going to pay homage to that land and that seat. The Messiah is going to be sitting on the throne. And he got it. He knows it. He not only knows it, he knows it so well, he's going to be the guy when he's dying, he's going to look over Judah and say, the lion's going through you. That's what he knows. He's going to put the blessing on Judah that's in the Torah. It's messianic. So he urged him, he pressed him, and he accepted it. So Esau accepted it. Travel on, he says, let's go together. I'll proceed along you. And Jacob, even after he got him to take the gift, you can see how completely trusting he is of his brother. He said to him, my Lord knows that the children are tender and the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. And if they be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I'll make my way at my slow pace according to the gate of the drove before me, the gate of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir. It's like, please, don't dawdle around here. You might change your mind and kill me. I mean, just go. Go home. I'm walking slow, I'm crawling, I'm with the kids, I'm with the flocks. You're a big man and you got a posse here. Just take the military and the tanks and, go home.
Yeah.
And I'll see you when I cross through, say you're over there. I'll be there in a couple days. Just give me a chance to, come by and wave on my way through.
Do you think
I'll try to go around it anyway.
Yeah,
but,
that your men are lonely. They want to get back to the
That's right, they want to get back. I'm being considerate.
Do you think
he's my brother.
Protect his wives?
Everything.
Dina?
He wants the guy out of there.
Everybody. Do you think he's going like,
absolutely.
Well, maybe Esau is going to take these instead of my flocks?
Sure, look at this. Esau says, well, then let me assign to you some people who are with me. You need a posse here. You need a royal escort. You need some military. You need some protection against the bandits. And here's what he says. To what purpose? To what purpose? I need protection against you is what I need. To what purpose? Let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes. See, I don't want your men to escort me. Somebody might kill me. I'll be okay. Just let me go alone. Unguarded.
So
I'm worried about one thing only. You.
He's still having anxiety about Esau.
He's having a big anxiety attack on him. So Esau started back that day on his way towards Seir, and Jacob breathed a sigh of delight. Well, sigh of relief. No. So but Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house. He wasn't even in a hurry to get by him in Seir. He stops in Succoth and he says, here, this is it. So he pays homage to his brother. He returns the blessing of preeminence. And then he goes to Succoth. And at Succoth, you know what's going to happen. This is a forerunner to the idea that when all the nations come against Israel, they're going to find out about Succoth. That when all the nations do an Esau trip and try to devour Israel, they're not going to get rain. And then they're going to come up from that time on, and they're going to be paying homage so they can get some rain back home. Because God, who puts the rain on the just and the unjust alike, in the millennium is going to play a different rule. He's going to have rain on one place and not on another. If you've got a wicked neighbor, you might find that it's raining across the street. But in this country, no. No rain. A big dividing line there called righteousness of the Lord. And he's going to go back to superintending the place. And that's why in Zechariah it says, and if they don't come, then they won't have rain. And if Egypt doesn't come, then it doesn't matter if they got the Nile River and they got all the water from Africa running through. They won't have rain either. They're going to run out of rain because it won't even rain on Africa. Everybody's going to find out about it. Water shortage. When it comes to Succoth, if they want to cut the rules on paying homage to the Messiah and the promised land. So, Jacob then goes over to Succoth and builds himself a house, and his livestock, he makes shelters, and therefore he called the name of the place Sukkot. So there he is. All of a sudden, he's putting up God's house in Sukkot. And, you know, the cattle have their house, and Jacob got his house, and everybody got their house, everybody have. Now, the picture here is Esau is dealing with his brother, and Jacob, in order to get through, pays tribute, pays him back. Now, when we get to Genesis 35, I'm going to do that, but I want to just quickly say something about the Haftorah and the Brit Chadashah. In the Haftorah, Obadiah is writing. You know who Obadiah is? What's Obed?
Obed?
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that Obed, the guy that...
A laborer, a slave.
Yeah.
Abodah, an Ebed. We're slaves in the household of God. And Paul is a bondservant of Yeshua. He's a slave in the house of Yeshua. And Obadiah, he's a slave. Obadiah, to God. To Yod Heh Vav Heh. This is a convert. And it's a convert from...
Edom.
So he's in Eliezer's position. And remember, Eliezer was a dancing charismatic Canaanite who became the heir, who then disinherited himself, and then he lived happily ever after in Abraham's house as a servant of the Lord. And now here's the end of the line of Edom, and it's Obadiah, and he's working too. He's in Ahab's past palace. Now Ahav, that's a great guy. Ah, his brother, and Av, his father, and this guy marries across the Israel. He's got a dynasty that runs through Israel as well as through Judah. And he's a bad guy, and he's on both sides of the line trying to mess everything up. And this guy, Ahab, is going messing everything up, and he's got an Edomite inside, and the guy that's serving him is an Edomite believer. And it's Obadiah, and he's writing. And he's saying what? He's looking at the struggle between two nations. Now, you know, Edom just had a big struggle with Jacob, and we see how it was resolved. God said the older, he ordained that the older was going to serve the younger, and yet in the short run, it meant Jacob bowing down seven times to give him back the blessing of preeminence. But what really happened is Edom wound up across the river, and later he becomes this nation that looks down on Israel when the enemy is in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And when he's looking down arrogantly saying, kill those guys, then God says, I'll kill you. Mm-hmm. And remember what we say about the humble will be exalted? The exalted will be broken down. So, you know, anytime you play win-lose, God's watching. Anytime you beat your breast and say, I won, God's watching. You're becoming an Edomite. Now, here's Obadiah. We're talking about life here. So here's a nation doing it. Picking up the struggle between the two nations, Obadiah prophesies that Edom's envy concerning Jacob's election, and the election was, you know, Genesis 27:41, is going to bring about Edom's ruin. And that's written here in verses 15 to 18 of this letter by Obadiah. A day is going to come when Edom watches with a contempt the destruction of Judah and Jerusalem without lifting a hand to hurt his to help his hurting brother. And that's Psalm 137, verse 7. He just looks down with utter contempt. And you read that psalm and you begin to say, oh, wow. So nations can feel that way. And then, oh, wow, when nations feel that way, even if they're high and mighty, and even if Israel or whoever they're looking down on is cambered, it's just a matter of time till what goes around comes around. And then after that, a final end? Scary. So think about it. Obadiah is the end of the line of Edom, and he's writing about the destruction of his nation for being arrogant against Israel. The contempt's a chilling reminder. It goes back to all these other patriarchs that have done this before. Lamech. Lamech's arrogance shortly before Cain's line is annihilated at the flood. Lamech says, if it took God this long to get around to punishing Cain, and in the tradition it's like he's seven generations away from Cain, and he's kind of blind, and he's being told by his son where to shoot, and he shoots into the brush, and Cain was there, and it killed him. And he goes, well, it took this long for Cain to be judged, you know, for the curse and all that. It'll take seven times 70 or 77 generations before it catches up with me, because, you know, I'm seven generations away, and I'm a bigger man still. And he didn't have a kid. The flood came and knocked him off. So, his kid was Tubal Cain, who was telling him where to go, but his kid Tubal Cain and him perished in the flood immediately, because Tubal Cain never has another son. So it's like All of a sudden, you look down with arrogance, and you and your child are cut off, and your nation's cut off, and you're gone. And now you're history, and now you're not going to be a nation to glory in, you know, this long life that we're talking about.
Now, the judgment, not the judgment, the destiny, I think,
yes,
of Edom is determined when Esau marries the Canaanite woman, right?
Well, yeah, at that point, he made his parents sad. But remember, the prophecy before he was even born is the older is going to serve the younger. So God weighs in when Rivka is saying, before the kids are born, what's going on here? And he said, well, you got two nations at war in your womb. Well, what's that mean? The older is going to serve the younger. Now, at that point, it's decided. And what I've said is that Abel was killed. Who was Abel? You know, a guy that was second born. And what happened to the poor second born? God took his sacrifice. And then what happened? His older brother killed him. So then what happens? The second born, killed by the primal carnivore firstborn. No justice? Where's his empire? Where are his kids? Where are his kids' kids? Well, he's a righteous. He doesn't have four generations of righteous. Never had a chance. Never had a chance to get married and have kids. Mm-hmm. Well, where's the justice here? I say God weighs in and feels sorry for him.
So it's a
I say when Yeshua comes even at the temple, he says, all this will fall on you. He's talking to us, the scribes and Pharisees at the temple, who are the gatekeepers for the problems of the world. And he says, from Abel, the first guy murdered in the Bible, you murdered, basically, to the last guy you murdered in the Bible, Zechariah, and the same kind of thing. Abel, blood screaming from the ground, you're driven out of the Garden of Eden. Now we got heaven on earth at the temple. Here we're beginning to expand the kingdom. You killed Zechariah. There, Zechariah dies. God, tell him, remember what they just did to me. Boom, he's dead, and the blood is out on the ground. It's the blood screaming at God again. And God says, okay. He sends Jesus 10 generations later. And Yeshua says, fill up the cup of your fathers. You say that you know, you wouldn't have done to if you'd have known, you wouldn't have done to Zechariah, you wouldn't have done to Abel, and meanwhile you're going to do it to me, and that proves it. Go ahead and fill up the cup and do it to me. And then he walks out and says the temple's under judgment, every stone will be torn down. So we killed Jesus outside the gates of Jerusalem, and to me it's unconfessed, unrepented, sinful, righteous at this point. In the meantime, what's happened is Jesus, before he pronounces the final judgment on the temple and says you're going to be scattered, it's 2,000 years, and my words will remain, but the temple is going to be a witness of this. It's like Jesus' last thing is seeing Abel. So to me, Abel's a second-born slain, and then Yitzhak comes along, and he's a second-born slain in faith because God tells Abraham, go up there and do the Akedah while I'm building this patriarchy. And if you want to think patriarchy, think Av. God the Father is building Av, his kingdom on earth. And he sets up his first representative, which is Avram. He's going to make him Av Hamon Goyim, and he's going to graft everybody into Abraham's family. He's going to make the most hospitable person on earth, because that's who he was. He picked him for that reason. And then he's going to have him visiting all his children and great-grandchildren. When he goes to the grave, all he's going to see is Esau fighting Jacob for the birthright. And Jacob, you know, got the sale and nobody talking about it. And then another 30, 40 years before the guys run out of town or something.
So does Jacob break the pattern? Jacob breaks the pattern of the
Isaac's
younger getting
No.
Played upon by the older?
No, because what will happen is...
But he's bowing and Esau goes off.
Right.
And he thinks he's... And Esau,
but it's not cured
because
what happens. In the Haftorah here... Now remember I say Torah is the blueprint. So in the blueprint, he does bow. But... He's really uptight. I'm telling you in the Torah, he's uptight.
He breaks the pattern, right?
No. He tries to transcend the pattern. But Edom doesn't break the pattern. So what happens later?
Edom gets absorbed.
Edom gets absorbed. Mm-hmm.
So then Edom is the last of the pattern?
No, because it's going to get passed down now to Zerach and Peretz. And Peretz is going to make a breach for himself. Don't kid yourself. It's twins born in the womb.
Right, okay.
That's no coincidence. One for one with Judah. And foreordained in the previous generation. So Zerah comes out. What do? They tie a red thread around his finger. And he's going to be first out. That's Esau right there. Then he pulls
in
Peretz. Peretz busts a breach out. He's a kingmaker. Breaches himself like a C-section. Comes out. And she goes, my, what a Peretz. And Peretz is firstborn now because he powered his way out of the womb. Now Zerah comes out, and he's got this red, so they name him Shining, to remind him all his life that he was the first finger out of the womb. And what does he do about it to his brother?
Loves him.
And when he does, hate him and look down with arrogance when bad things are happening to him, the way Edom does. When Edom does it, Obadiah writes the epitaph on Edom. It goes into this Haftorah in Vayishlach, which was then solving this problem, saying, well, Jacob kind of got by, but Edom really was just in a good mood, but he didn't get by. And when he matured, his nation was happy to see Jacob's nation eating it.
So wait a minute, I forgot, what happens with Perez again?
Perez comes out.
Zerah disappears, right?
Zarach is the name, and it means shining.
He's the second one. Right?
No, he has a whole...
Around.
He's got a clan.
Oh.
But Zarach's got a clan, Perez has a clan, but Perez is going to make it the Messiah. But what's Matthew going to say? Matthew's going to say, you know, Tamar was part of this. Tamar, you know, was with mm-hmm. Judah, and she had twins. And thanks to Tamar wanting to preserve Levirate birthright, we got Lydia, so put her in. And she's a woman mentioned.
But then worthy, though.
Worthy. And then Zerah, well, anybody in is worthy.
Right.
And then Zerah is mentioned. Now, he's just a dead end for Messiah. He's the guy's uncle. He's in the line. How many other uncles of Jesus are in the line? Zerah is there because he solved the problem. He didn't have sibling rivalry to go kill his power. He wasn't arrogant. He wasn't looking down with contempt over this guy saying, oh, it's finally that guy got it. You know, he breached out of the womb, trying to try to be a father of Jesus over me when I got my finger out first.
So they broke the
mold. I hate
mold.
That guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Zerah and Perah broke the mold. Okay.
They broke the mold. And that's what I'm saying. It took another generation. That's why I'm taking a lot of time. And I'm saying Matthew's going to signal that when he gives us the genealogy.
So it is possible. I mean, it does happen.
Absolutely happens.
So there is some kind of mercy.
No, no, I'm going to say Genesis, the whole thing is solved once. And I'm saying we've got to ride on that. And I'm saying we're working over solved problems. It's just that when it generalizes, you know, there's moments of truth where free will is in there, and, you know, you've got a momentum going one way, but you've also got the ability to choose to
put functions in that combination to make that happen.
Well, you've got pressures on you, and the question is whether you're going to live in the darkness or live in the light.
So Zerah and Perah.
If you have saving faith, you say, I'm going to do what's right, and God will save me. If you don't have saving faith, then you're going to live in the darkness, and then God's going to judge it. And it's your choice. And guys have judged it right, and they got out of here okay. And Eliezer was a good example. And guys have played with both sides of the equation, and they got their clock clean. And that's what just happened to Jacob. And I'm saying, you know, your turn is coming, so look out.
It's all right.
Now, Edom's Kamas, lawlessness against his brother, this is Obadiah verses 10 and 11. Edom's Kamas, his lawlessness against his brother, goes back to Hagar's Kamas against Sarah. Because what happened? Who intermarries? You see, after Jacob leaves, he says, go get yourself some wives from, you know, Shemite. Don't marry these Canaanites. Because you can't have Canaanite blood. We're wiping the Canaanites out. Why? Well, that goes back to the ark and people uncovering, you know, the father's nakedness. And God didn't go for that. And it goes back to promiscuous ways that people are living in Canaan. And we've got to clean the place up starting this festival, this cesspool. And look at these guys today. You know, they're on Time Magazine with blood on their hands. They're very proud to push Jews out of the windows and have the blood on their hands. You know, that's the same thing that God wants to wipe out. And it doesn't matter that Hanan Shraui gets up and says, we're direct descendants of the Canaanites. I've got it. So that means we have a claim on the land. I mean, this woman doesn't know what she's talking about. She wants to be adopted Canaan. But you know, it's the ethic and it's the way you're living. When you got suicide bombers and blood on your hand and you're proud, it's like the clock's ticking on you. Because historically, God levels these guys over time. Whether they're Canaanites or anybody else who walk around with their brother's blood on their hand. It's like Jesus came and cared about Abel's blood. He cares about carnivores killing people and leaving blood on the open ground. He doesn't like it. He's trying to clean that up. And he's going to wipe that out by the time he sets up the kingdom of heaven because he's into sanctifying life and he doesn't like seeing blood shed and people just being arrogant. So this is something God's really down on. And through history, he judges. He comes in and judges. So Hamas, you go to this arrogance and this lawless behavior, and you get this word Hamas coming in and out of the scripture. And it comes in with Hagar. Hagar showed Hamas for Sarah. Now, when Hagar is having kids, one of her kids, she has Ishmaelites. Well, what happens when Esau finds out that his parents didn't like it, that he, you know, had two wives, Adah and Anan.
Two of the wrong wives.
Adah and Anan or something. You know, they were both Canaanite wives.
He goes and marries an Ishmaelite.
He goes and gets Basemat. And when he wears Basemat,
he thought that would help.
Yeah, she was an Ishmaelite. So finally got an Ishmaelite into the picture. Now look what's happening here. Here's an Esau-Ishmaelite combination. And what you had is Hagar against Sarah, and you got Edom now against his brother, and prior to that you had Cain. And so you've got this whole lawlessness side, and with it this arrogance looking down and saying, and so Edom gets overthrown, and Obadiah is writing the epitaph, and he says, Edom will be thrown down, and his kingdom will become the Lord's. And that's verse 20 and 21.
And is that Esau being basically blind, or is he basically having no consideration for what his parents are?
He didn't feel like going back to marry a Shemite, I can tell you that.
Because of his wrath towards Jacob?
He was angry.
Saying, you know, I don't want to partake in what you're doing.
He's a man of the earth. He goes out and sees a woman, and he gets turned on, and he grabs her, and that's his wife. That's who he is. You know, give me the ribbon! You know, birthright, what good will it do me if I die? And God says, I hate that.
So he's a man of the moment.
He is absolutely a sensual man of the moment. And he really knows how to indulge his senses when he's indoor. Yeah. He's great at it.
So that's the picture we're
painting. He's fantastic at it. Yeah. And God looks at it and he says, if he's that cavalier with a birthright, and then it's in Malachi, Jacob I loved and Esau I hated. Right there in Malachi. God hates that. And what does it go back to? Because he rejected the birthright. So if you rejected the birthright, you'll find out. We'll see what you think about it. And now you look, and there's 284 million Ishmaelite intermarried with Esauite guys called the Arabs. And what do they want? Jerusalem. Why do they want Jerusalem?
They want to prove that their God, whoever that is stronger than the God of Jerusalem.
Do you know that Islam has never faced Jerusalem to pray?
No.
It's Mecca, Medina.
Yeah.
You never face Jerusalem. The third holiest is only the third holiest because the temple's sitting there. Otherwise, they wouldn't care about it at all. Yeah. They didn't care about it during the time of Islam. And they made up a myth after the guy died saying that...
The horse?
Yeah. After the guy's dead.
Yeah.
Okay? Well, when he was dead, he ascended to heaven. He did. Well, no one saw him. Well, that's because it was from the Temple Mount.
Well, that's so they
could
claim.
The only time he went to the temple.
That's so they could claim.
The only time in his life that he ever went to the temple that he never heard of or saw. Okay? Never heard of or saw. And the reference in the Quran to that is the outer post. And, you know, I mean, outer post is like, it could have been north, south, east, or west. It's like the edge of wherever your empire happens to be right now. And so later on, about 50 years later, 60 years later, they're out there in Jerusalem and they go put up the Dome of the Rock and they say the guy ascended from heaven and we found... Now we built the place where it actually was from. It was the temple. So, you know, that's how he got up there on a horse and did it. And, you know, he was dead in Mecca, Medina, where he already died.
He was born in one and died the other.
Yeah.
I think he's buried in the other.
Yeah. So I can't keep it straight right now.
I don't remember which one it is.
But if you read the Quran, it's like it's got two halves. And one half is make peace with the infidel. Yeah. Okay? And that's when you're weak. And if we call it arbitrarily the Mecca stage.
That's right.
Then Medina he takes by force, and it can be backwards. But you could have started with Mecca, Medina and going to Mecca. But whatever it was, the first place, when you're weak, you make peace with the people of the book, and that's the Jews and the Christians. But then when you're strong,
he took Medina first,
you break all your alliances and you kill everybody.
And take that.
You know, and the only reason they really want to kill everybody is it says fight them and subdue them until they pay taxes.
Right.
Once they pay taxes, you're fine. So all they want to do is make second-class citizens out of us. They don't want to drive us into the sea. They want to drive us into the sea so we'll pay taxes. And then the rest of us, they want a big population paying taxes. They don't want to kill many. They'd be happy to kill one guy and make everybody else pay taxes. They preserve everybody. Just make you second-class citizen in the Islamic Republic and pay taxes, and then we'll be happy. We'll leave you alone.
Well, no, they're still not going to leave you alone.
Yeah, you just pay taxes.
Well, the golden age.
They're going to take whatever they want from your family, too.
The Ottoman Empire is happy to take
15%, 20%. They made them filthy rich.
Yeah. Just pay 20%.
Didn't they cut all the trees in Israel?
Thousand years.
In the land,
church.
They cut all the trees down for the taxes that they owe them?
Yeah, whatever. They want taxes. But as long as you pay taxes, then that's fine. So, anyhow, the point here then is that Edom is thrown down at verses 20 and 21, and he's judged by Obadiah. So, we'll jump back quickly then to... Genesis 35. The new covenant one, by the way, is just by trusting Yitzhak and his blessings over Yaakov, and Esau made reference to events yet to come. And we're talking about faith. And in this one, the new covenant basically says Eden's failure is going to be Israel's gain only if Israel's holy. So if you don't get sanctified as a nation, you're still going to have to wait because God isn't through working with you. And it isn't enough to say you can gain at the other guy's expense. If everybody else is horrible, we have to be pounded down enough to be sufficiently humble to be able to inherit. And that's, otherwise we won't inherit, because we'll be the hand. But in general, when God is pounding us down, then we're becoming humble, and you know that's good. So there's an irony here. And the irony is, if you're going to be arrogant and build up, what choice does God have? If he cares enough about
humble.
You, he's going to humble you. Mm-hmm. Humble yourself in the sight of the Lord, for he won't lift you up.
Higher and higher.
That's it. He won't lift you up. So that's basically what Hebrews 11 through 20 is saying to us. It says, well, you're not going to inherit unless you're humble too. It's not enough to be gloat over your punishment. That will cost them and their nation their eternal life, but that doesn't mean you will inherit. So what will he inherit then? Go back to Genesis 35, and it's just marvelous. What God promises Jacob, there's a two-part promise here in Genesis 35:11. He says they're going to... This is Jacob after he's walking the circuit, and he's coming back into the land, and the heritage is passing now from generation to generation. And Jacob's back in the land that God swore to give Abraham and to Isaac and their seed. Mm-hmm. And so Jacob is the seed, right? So he'd heard the promise first for himself in Beit El, house of the Lord, where he first promised God's presence and said, you give me a safe return and I'll tithe forever. And I really tried to explain that this was goodwill on his part. It wasn't blackmailing God. It wasn't showing how bad a guy he was. It was really more like, if I can see from my experience that you're not a local deity, then I commit for life. And now I'm going out with you, and if you can get me back to this place, then I'm tithing for life. So he gets back, and the journey's gone full circle, and Jacob sets up this place, and he commemorates it. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the pattern, I mean, just imagine Sinai pattern. What happens at Sinai? Children of Israel come out of Egypt, get rid of the idols, wash, sanctify, prepare, get yourself ritually pure, and then you can stand, your elders can stand on the mountain, you walk up the holy mountain, and you can begin going up to the place where heaven meets earth. And where heaven met earth, the guys that ascend the highest, even higher than the elders and higher than the priests. And these guys are further and further off the mountain, which is holy. You've got to be sanctified to be up there, or the wrath of God is going to break out against you. And that's what the priesthood is going to be about, and that's what a sanctified nation is going to be about. Priesthood telling you what the rules are for living in God's house so you can keep the rules. Just like I say, I don't let the dog come into the library. Comes in the library, he's going to shed in here, he's going to take a dump in here. They don't want it, so I tell him he can't come in. He respects the house rules, he knows he won't come in here. So he stays out there, he knows what the house rule is. He's close, but you know, he won't come in. Children of Israel are destined to inherit this land, so they follow in Jacob's footsteps, they discard their idols, and then they cleanse and change their clothes. Jacob gets rid of all the household idols from Laban, and all that everybody pulled out of the Aramean country, and they get rid of that, and then they change their clothes, and then they ascend to build Beit El, basically, the house of the Lord. They're going to call it something a little different. And when you get to 35 here, when they've gotten back, Jacob is in the land, and God appears to him, and he says, your name is Jacob, you shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel shall be your name. And verse 11, God said to him, I am El Gibor, I mean God Almighty, El Shaddai. And then he says, be fruitful and multiply. Where have we heard this before?
Genesis
1:28, Adam is told, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Now, the picture I see on this is if you're fruitful and multiply, you're going to have a household that's godly. And if your households are multiplying and they're godly, it's like it's just a matter of time until you take over the earth. It doesn't require anything more than just being fruitful and multiplying and filling the earth. If you're fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth, you're like a cancer cell in the human body. You'll turn the whole thing your way. You see? So he says, be fruitful and multiply. And this is God talking to Jacob. A nation and a company of nations. Now, that's interesting language.
Is that the word goyim?
Yes, but...
So then...
What? 35 verse 11. I want to read you these words, because it's not just goyim I'm after. 35:11 says, Vayirmala Elohim ani El Shaddai, pre urve. That's the be fruitful and multiply in the plural. Goy ukahal goyim. So I goy, a nation, and a kahal goyim. What's a kahal?
A house?
Congregation. Kehilat, you know, Kehilat.
Yeah, okay.
Abraham and so on.
All right.
Yeah. Well, Kehilat usually has a minion.
Of nations.
Right? Can I have a minion to have a Kehilat? You understand?
So Kang?
At least. Otherwise, you've got nothing. You need a minion to go pray. Hey, what did God tell Lot, Abraham?
Sounds too prophetic.
Well, what happened when Abraham was negotiating with Sodom and Gomorrah?
He'd spare it if there were ten.
He'd spare it for a minion.
Yeah.
Spare the whole city for a minion. No kehilah, no spiritual kehilah, you're gone.
Mm-hmm.
So here he's telling Jacob, you're going to have a goy, a nation, and a kahal goyim, and a congregation of nations. Well, what happens in the northern kingdom?
They assimilate.
Yeah, right. At the first, how many of them are there?
Ten.
And they're called Israel.
Right.
And because two half tribes are up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then down south, you got Judah, Simeon, and some Levites.
Mm-hmm.
So you got two or three down south, and you got ten up north.
Right.
And the ten, now remember what happened with the spies? How many went up to the land?
12.
And the two gave a good report?
Right.
Yeah. The ten go? And later on, we want to be like the nation. So, that, okay, you got a nation and a kahal. Nations. And you want to go with dominion? You want dominion to be a corporate body, and you want to have it out? Okay, Israel, you can do that. So Israel goes up there in the north, and they're going to put golden calves in Bethel, right in the house of the Lord where the ladder goes up to heaven. Right where the Machanaim are going up and down when you're going to go into captivity. Let's put an idol right there so the nations, so the angels won't accompany you into diaspora. And on top of that, let's make sure that idol keeps all the money that would go to God and his temple and redlines it away from there to keep it up in the nation here. Now you can really become like the nations because you're succeeding in withholding tithes from God and you got an idol right there in the house of the Lord, including one blocking the escalator to heaven.
So you do the...
And then send 19 kings along, and every one of them doesn't depart, and that's the previous half Torah, that every one of them does not depart from the sins of the first man, the big man, the head of the kahal, who's an Ephraimite, whose name is...
The Ephraimites?
Adam.
No, before Adam.
Before Adam? Oh, Yerubam.
The first king, right, Yerubam.
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 Yerubam. And so, Yerubam, you won't be like him. Yeah, and he put up the golden. Yeah, and you don't pull it down? No. 19 generations, you don't pull it down? That's right. Well, congratulations. You just made it to Terach, and you got an idol sitting around the temple.
So these idols are...
Gee, what did you do after 19 generations of Terach? Goodbye! And there's your...
Is that a reality?
Well, now we'll call it occupied territories, and we won't let you back in there, and we'll have the world call it the occupied territories, and we'll take your guys, and what did you want to do? You want to be like the nations? Well, the biggest, strongest nation around is Assyria. We'll put you over there, and you can add to their population. You can be a good Assyrian here. Why don't you just marry in, assimilate, and let your great-great-grandchildren of the fourth or fifth generation be some of the most prominent Assyrians in the world? You got it. And so here we are walking around saying, man, what are these Palestinians that are calling themselves Plishtim who claim descendancy to the Canaanites? What are they doing? In the world, they won't leave it alone. They call it the occupied territories. Duh.
But they
gee, what
the
do we do to contribute
out
to this problem? Oh, history's got a memory. All right, so you get a picture here. Now, here Jacob's being told right up front at the beginning, and I'm telling you, this Bible, it reads like it was written, you know, for today's newspaper, because he's sitting there saying, I'll give you a nation and a kahal goyim, a nation and a congregation nation, so descend from you, and kings will issue from your loins. Now we're looking at Esau's kingdom, and the guy can't keep two kings in a row. We get to Israel, and the whole thing's going to go back and forth. Judah's going to at least keep having somebody from David's loins sitting on there. Judah, Israel, they're going to be back and forth. They're going to have all kinds of guys in there. Well, and they're going to lose a ranch over this. So, meanwhile, the line of David, God is going to preserve with Chesed Be'emet. I went over that very carefully, and when we were dealing with Chayei Sarah, I was saying, here's the way the household for the princess in God's house is formed. And the princess obviously becomes a queen and gives birth to a king, and then you've got a line. So you've got Av, raised up. You've got Sarah raised up, and then you've got a royal couple raised up, and then they have a royal family, and the royal family's got a household that goes across generations. You've got a patriarchy, and you line it up to Judah, four generations, and there's your righteous Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and believe it or not, Judah, even though he's going to get his clock cleaned out there, but he's going to figure it out, and you're going to have four righteous, and then you had Shem before this, along with Shelah, and who are the four? To Aver. This is after Adam, after Noah. You had Shem, and then you had Arpachshad. Arpachshad is how old? You know, Arpachshad is born with it when his father Shem is how old? 100.
500.
So, Shem had a kid at the age of 100 after he stepped out of the ark. And Abraham, he laughs his guts out when he figures out that he's going to be like a good Shemite, and when he's 100, he's going to have a good kid. And it's going to be Yitzhak. He's going to laugh over Arpachshad and what he missed. And Arpachshad's going to be around along with Shem and Shelah and Aver. Look at the when they die, 2158, 2096, 2146, 2187. And, you know, interesting thing, Aver, after he has a kid, he'll live 430 years. Israel's going to go down into captivity 430 years before they come out of Egypt. And Aver's still going to be around. They go to Yitzhak's bris. And not just Aver, but Shem, Arpachshad, Shelah, and Aver. That's four generations. So you see, these guys are going to be following their fathers, their kids, 10 generations later. They'll be around. And in terms of the family and patriarchs and seeing things from afar, they're going to see Isaac show up. And that's going to be so ingrained in Jewish culture that me, I'm a fifth-generation American Jew. I never met my great-great-grandmother, but my father told me that when my great-great-grandmother was like pushing 100 and some, no one knew how old she really was, but she was well over 100. And she was saying, Sydney, hurry up and have a kid already, because when you have a kid, I go straight to heaven. Mm-hmm. Now, our family was assimilated 4 generations, and she still knew that Bubba Mises, that if they're 4 generations, the 5th generation goes straight to heaven. Mm-hmm. And she was telling him, hurry up and have Jeffrey. And my dad, he got around to it when he was 44. She had a long way, but it didn't work for her. But she told him that, and he remembered that to tell me. And he wasn't bar mitzvah. My father. And my father died 97 years old last year. This year. So, these kind of things, they're really biblical patterns go all the way back to here. And even though I just know this from my father, who's 97, I'll bet I can verify that's all over the Jewish community. And religious guys, they'll say, oh yeah, of course. And which tells me that when you're an Av to the 4th generation, now you got a household that's holy. If you got a household that's holy and it's passed Torah as a heritage for 4 generations, I'd like to get together a minion of Messianic Jews and have them go over and live in Jerusalem and say, Deuteronomy 21, Lord, we're sorry that our city killed Yeshua. And he'll feel welcome to come back because we'll cleanse that land. Now, give me 2-3 generations and I want to see that happen. Anyhow, that being said, Jacob here is being told, well, you go out there and you have yourself a nation and you have a congregation of nations. And so he's going to do that. In 35, 10 and 11, he says, be fruitful, multiply, and a nation and a company of nations will come from you, and kings shall come forth from you. And the land which I give to Abraham and Isaac, I will give to you, and I will give the land to your seed after you. And there's the promise across 3 generations. There's the patriarchy. There's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on your way. Jacob renamed Israel, and now you're going to have a nation of Israel. And we see it's going to split under Shlomo after the first king comes in. Bingo, you're going to have the dominion up there and the one below. And all that is a microcosm itself for the idea that Abraham is going to have grafted in Yeshua all these kehilat of goyim. Because the way God will get them back, in my opinion, is that every nation, tribe and kindred is going to bow before the King of Kings, and they're going to come to Jerusalem. And when they do, what do you know? They're going to bring with them the believers, the real believers. And when God reassembles those believers, those assimilated believers, those non-Jewish assimilated believers, I still think you're going to find that he's going to assemble for himself Adam's family in a way that makes a lot of sense in the millennium. And we're going to look around and say, gee, God was keeping track even though we can't. I'm saying this, against the Ephraimites, but, the point is, I'm saying you can't know if you're assimilated or primary. But I'm saying at the same time that God's going to show covenant kindness to Jacob. And even though we lost the company of nations that came from him up north, and we assimilated, and we don't know what happened to them, and they didn't come back. And there's little pockets here there, but we really don't know too much about where these guys are. That God has still been showing that covenant kindness to Jacob because he's kept Israel preserved. And in the process of doing that, he had Jacob himself make a prophecy concerning who the real king is going to come out of, and it's going to be Judah. And we'll have to get to that later. And then you'll see a covenant kindness that was established with Rivka and then is mediated through Jacob and then given to Judah and then passed along to David and to his line. And it's a line that's not broken all the way to Jesus, all the way to Yeshua, the one who saves in person. And so we're getting the one who saves in person. So after that, the rest of Vayishlach runs out pretty quickly here. Seir's land first. Esau takes over the land of Seir the Horite. It starts out that he's got a little patch of grass out there, a little field. And then after a while, Edom dispossesses Seir, not by intermarriage, but by setting up a dynasty, and he's fruitful, multiply, and he fills the land. And in the process, Abraham's there's a daughter, a granddaughter, who is born to Seir, the Horite, and his granddaughter is named Timnah. Yeah. And Timnah knows, just like Obadiah knows, that his nation is perishing, and Timnah doesn't want to see Seir and the Horites go down. But you know the Canaanites are gone, and she believes it. She believes that much, but she doesn't know enough to realize that the promises made to Abraham are also made to Isaac and Jacob. And so when she goes to intermarry to try to live forever, she says, I want to intermarry some Abraham descendant. And she picks the wrong line. Who does she marry?
Ishmael.
She marries Eliphaz. And Eliphaz is...
she marries Eliphaz.
Eliphaz is on the Edom side of the equation. Esau side. Yeah. So here's an Edomite married to a Canaanite. Okay. And she's got the wrong side of Abraham. And she's going to have a son, and his name is going to be Amalek. And what is Amalek going to do? You know, he's a cross between Esau and the Canaanites. Yeah. So when Israel gets out of the wilderness, and every nation in the world has fear of the Lord.
He's a bad dream.
He's a bad dream, all right. And so he's going to say, you know, I just figured out you can attack the women and children and get away with it.
Picks them off.
And so he picks them off. He goes and he attacks from the rear. And he attacks the weak and the frail and the slow.
What does that seem?
And he attacks the other, and it's right there in Deuteronomy 25, 17, 18.
Sounds like a modern day terrorist, doesn't it?
Sometimes. And so God orders war forever against Amalek as a result. Mm-hmm. She picked the wrong line and the wrong side.
Do you know that when scribes start writing, when they get their ink ready and everything, first thing they write is Amalek, and then they X it out.
Yeah.
Really? They blot it out. That's
wow.
And that's because later on Haman is going to be an Amalek. The son of Amalek. Mm. And he's going to come through the Persians and try to totally annihilate us. And that's because we didn't annihilate
Haman.
And because we didn't follow and annihilate all the Amalekites.
But Haman didn't even have close to the authority that Amalek did.
Well, when he was in Persia, we were in trouble.
Yeah, but he was... Yeah, you're right, but I don't see him standing a chance next to Amalek.
Well, if we'd have been in Esther's kingdom at the time, he had all the Medes and Persians on his side, and he had the law of the Medes and Persians once it was decreed to go knock off all the Jews. Mm-hmm. And Ahasuerus didn't know what was going on, and Haman built a gallows, so 75 feet. That the tables got turned.
I don't see him commanding them.
So notice what we have then. We've got the breaking of Jacob, and as a result, God builds Jacob's nation. Meanwhile, we've got Esau being contemptuous, they're going to get eliminated. We've got Amalek being contemptuous, they're going to be eliminated. And we've got so contemptuous nations are getting tossed down while the people that are being broken are getting covenant kindness from God and being lifted up, and with it our promises. And yet if we make wrong decisions like the Kehillah of the Goyim that were promised to Jacob that wound up in Israel, the 10 nations that went after the 10 spies, then unlike Judah and Caleb, the 10 there that went with the majority saying
We don't trust in God. We trust in what we're looking at and playing by the rules of the world rather than that God can raise from the dead and that God can bestow saving faith and that he's good for his promises. And even no matter what it looks like. And so the 10 against the 2, we got hung up in the wilderness with the spies. We lost Israel with the 10. And went our separate ways because we decided to repeat the sins of the golden calf. By building the golden altars in Dan and Bethel. So here's Israel being torn in half over arrogance. Here's Amalek getting torn to pieces. Edom being torn to pieces. Obadiah writing the epitaph. And so we see that nations go the way of men when it comes to arrogance and when it comes to humility.
Now, why does God give Jacob this type of blessing? Is it a prophetic one?
It certainly played out that way.
Right.
You know, when he's all these blessings that deal with the future, when you're talking about your seed and the nations, yeah. But remember, they really are understanding that they're going to have dynasties and that they're going to have nations and that they're going to have territory. That this is all right up front, everybody knows. These are nations. And Genesis is not only the story of God building his house and unifying his family in order to build his kingdom on earth and overcoming problems along the way, like whether you trust him and like whether you're arrogant and like whether you're humble and like whether you have sibling rivalry. These kind of things have to be blotted out so that you're a son of light. And when you're walking in the light, then God is pleased to make his light dwell. And Matthew, when they say, let your light shine before men, that they might just go dot, 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 glorify your Father which is in heaven. You see, the idea is you turn your light on and they turn their light on. And what's happening is you've got an expansion of the kingdom of light. And the works, nobody's trying to justify themselves by work righteousness. Works can be something that God's doing through you. It's a fruit of who you are. That's the way it's supposed to be. And to me, a real work is doing good things God's way. And to do it God's way, you've got to be walking in the light. Otherwise, you're liable to do it too early, too much, too slow, not in time, the wrong way, and so on.
Hagar.
Like Hagar. Take Hagar and make in vitro, my property. Make a son. And, 284 million years later, Abraham is still looking at that. And so are we.
How does this fit with the idea that God scattered the Jews throughout the world to bring civilization to the world?
It was plan B. Originally we were supposed to be fruitful and multiply. We'd spill over the borders. If Ishmael is up to 284 million, just imagine how many Jews there would be in this world if we hadn't been slaughtered by the Romans and if we hadn't been slaughtered by
the Assyrians.
And so on. And Hitler. The three rounds we got. But each of those rounds was because we kept going down the road that dealt with the fact that if we didn't... God basically said in the covenant, you're in the covenant whether you like it or not. Because the fathers said, Naseh v'nishma, and they obligated the people who would be born thereafter. It's like, you might have no nation except for God. You have no nation because of Isaac. It was like, there wouldn't be an Isaac except for God. Ex nihilo. And after that, you won't have a nation except for God. And then Abraham comes along, he's going to cut Isaac's throat. You won't have a nation except for God. The angel shows up and says, okay, because you believe you could receive him back from the dead. Saving faith here again. So now no nation's going to exterminate him. And God swears an oath. Okay, he swears an oath then that we're going to be immortal as a nation. They're never going to wipe us out. Can't. Period. Always going to be a minion anyway. I don't care if it gets down to 10. You're going to have 10. God guaranteed it to Abraham. Mm-hmm. And I don't care what we do, he's going to find some way to make sure there's at least 10.
At least 10 Jews left.
At least
right?
10 Jews.
Well, he would have started over with Moshe.
Even if they're really close to the Mediterranean and the 350 billion Arabs are...
No matter what. I mean, already it's out of hand. There's 6 billion people in the world right now, and there's 284 million Arabs, and there's 13 million Jews. It's out of hand already. And we're still, got a nation and walking around. I mean, it's impossible. You got to understand history to see it. But what he said was, if you're fruitful, multiply, you'll fill the earth and subdue it. But if you're not, if you don't walk in covenant blessing, then you're going to walk in the cursing side. Cursing side, God withdraws favor. When he withdraws favor, you don't have as much power as you need to live. Then what happens? Oh, you lose your spare change. Then you lose your house. Then you sell yourself into bondage. Then you wind up in a foreign land. Then you wind up serving a foreigner in a foreign land and serving their gods.
Yeah.
And this is because you won't toe the line. You won't live according to house rules. You won't keep the covenant. You won't trust that you're under Torah and that that's God's instruction for you. So.